this week is Parsha Kitisa and Parshat Para. So it's just like, I assume because of the combination, we definitely should be talking about what? Yes, correct. So I guess we have to talk about the ego, certainly with the combination. So let's begin. I think that the question that I want to deal with today is, how did the sin come about? And perhaps as a connected issue, who exactly was guilty for doing this? I mean, the other issue is, what exactly did they do, which I don't want to get into. We've discussed that before. But before we actually read the verses, I do want to point something out. And that is that modern man approaches ancient man with an incredible bias. We allow ourselves to look at certain things symbolically and not to think twice about it. When we look at ancient men who may have been looking at certain things symbolically, we judge them for looking at things literally. I'll give you an example. If you had, let's say, an anthropologist 150 years from now find themselves a copy of a video of a college football game, and if they heard that one team's name, let's say for argument's sake, is the Bears and the other team was the Falcons, do you think that they would right away understand that this is just names and doesn't mean anything else? Or would they start talking about why in California they're related to Falcons and why, or Atlanta as the case may be, Falcons, and why in other places related to Bears, without allowing that the whole thing is symbolic? And then they would say there was a whole rite, people would paint their faces colors to match it. And again, I would feel very bad for the anthropologist who would actually be subjected to this. But we know that it just doesn't mean anything. And even the people there know that it doesn't mean anything. But it's symbolic, and it's symbolic on a, I would say, on a very removed level. But when we look at people who worshipped idolatry, we tend to look at that as being absolutely literal. And we say, oh no, literally, this is what they believed. And my question is, why don't we allow at least any symbolism within what they were doing? Because I think there was a lot more symbolism than we normally are willing to consider. And that was something which we touched a couple of weeks ago in terms of the relationship between the Egel and between the Merkava and between the Kruvim. And maybe we'll come back to an element of that today. But let's first look at the verses themselves. So what's wrong about worshiping an ego? Is it bowing down to it? Is it, or is it believing that the ego actually has powers?
Well, they said they want to have another god, so another symbol.
Well, it's interesting which word they use. Which
said
would, right, but they didn't say Yud Kei Vav Kei.
No.
Okay.
And a special name for a special god.
And they did something else which was interesting. Let's read it because. The people see that Moshe tarried in coming down from the mountain. Come make for us, let's call Elohim a god, that will walk in front of us. For Moshe, the man who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. Which means that the idea of the Egel is certainly, within this verse, within this context, a replacement for Moshe, and not a replacement for God.
For Moshe the man.
Right, for Moshe the man. It stresses it. So it could be you can say that men are here today and God tomorrow, or men are fickle, or maybe all men are fickle. And over here saying, let's replace Moshe with something which is a little bit more sturdy, let's replace Moshe with an Egel, let's replace it with some kind of a god. All that's fine. But the idea, and again, this is the main thrust of the Kuzari's argument, which, again, the argument is made famous by the Kuzari, Ibn Ezra, and others, that there was no replacement of God in the Chet Egel, but rather the replacement is the replacement of Moshe. And as I said, when you read this verse, it sounds quite clear. See, we also get fooled. We get fooled by ourselves. And we discussed this, Shirley. We get fooled by ourselves, and this is something we discussed also a number of weeks back, that we say that Yitzhak Mitzrayim was loy ayyadei shaliach, that it wasn't with any kind of agent. What did we? Anybody remember what we said then, or no? We forgot. Which? Yeah. That statement was in the context of Makap B'chorot. It wasn't with everything else. Makap B'chorot was not with any kind of a shliach. When it comes to going out of Egypt, God says to Moshe, "Please go and take them out." So over here, Yitzhak Mitzrayim was ayyadei shaliach. And here, the shaliach isn't here, so let's replace Moshe. So now the question is, do you replace Moshe with another man, or do you replace Moshe with something else? Now, why they would have chosen Egel, as I said, that's a very good question. But are they replacing God, or are they replacing Moshe? Now, what's the problem with the Avodah Zarah? And your, look, your proof is a wonderful proof. God says it's wrong. Moshe says it's wrong. But what's wrong? Is what's wrong about it that you're not supposed to make a graven image and worship it? Whether you believe that that graven image is God, or whether you believe that graven image is just a power, or has any kind of power, or can help you in any way, what are you not allowed to do to Avodah Zarah? You can't worship it. It doesn't make a difference if you say, listen, I know that there's really a God. I know there's really one God. But, you know what, that eagle's really cute. I'd love to bow down to this eagle. What's wrong? You're not allowed to bow down to it. You're not allowed to do Avodah Zarah, and it doesn't make a difference as far as what your belief is. Your belief is a whole separate problem. The thing about Avodah Zarah, in terms of the Egel, it's the performance. It's what they did with it. But again, let's read. Shirley?
I just wonder, if they were replacing with a man, why didn't they just nominate
Adam? As we say, because men are fickle. Men are here today, gone tomorrow. Cows are loyal. Even the best of them. But the see, part of the problem over here really is that they underestimate Moshe, because they stress that Moshe is a man. If Moshe is a man and he went up with limited supplies, how can he be up there for 40 days and 40 nights without food? If it really is Moshe the man, then Moshe couldn't have made it.
But wait a second,
don't you see the solution? What's the solution? No, Moshe's not really a man. That's the solution. Do you realize that? That if Moshe's not really a regular man, and Moshe could survive without eating and without drinking, and Moshe's a little different from everybody else, then you have the problem. Because what's their problem? Moshe's not here. They're getting nervous. It can't be that Moshe's still alive. Then you have the wonderful midrash that the Satan shows Moshe's dead body floating around. So, okay, Moshe's gone. Moshe's dead. We need something which is a little more permanent. And any person that you take will also just be a person. So what was the background for the Chet HaEgel? Because they underestimated Moshe. They thought Moshe was only a man. But that, again, realize that that's part of the sin. If they would have realized what Moshe really was, that Moshe had the capacity, or God had the capacity to make Moshe have the capacity to subsist on spiritual food for 40 days and 40 nights, then they wouldn't have gotten to this point. So just, again, if you read that verse again.
They only got to that point on the 40th day.
So, and correct. And if you read the verse, you realize that that's also part of the problem. Now, Vayomer lehem Aharon parku. Now, parku is a very strong word. You know, just like lefrok means to get rid of. Yeah. Lefrok nizmei hazahav asher ba'oznei nesheichem b'neichem uvenoteichem v'viyo elai. Now, those who want to play defense attorney for Aaron claim that this is the first stage of defense. The men want to do it. Again, according to various midrashim, the women don't want to do it. The men want to sin, the women don't want to sin. So Aaron has a great plan. He goes, great, go tell your wives and children, give me all the jewelry. Which he figured that there's no chance that the thing continues afterwards. And you can decide if the pshat is including the women or not. He takes it from their hand. Who are we talking about? Aaron. What does Aaron do? He forms it with the cheret. Now, part of the problem we're going to have is knowing what the word cheret is. Rashi says, Rashi gives us two interpretations for Cheret, which you don't have in front of you. One is what this Art Scroll Saperstein edition English Rashi with translation of the Chumash as well reads. First I'll read the English translation of the verse according to this. He took it from their hands and bound it in a scarf. It understands that Cheret is a scarf. And he's getting that from the comment of Rashi. Yesh l'targamo b'shnei panim. There's two ways of translating this. Ha'eched v'yatzar lashon kshira. One possibility is that v'yatzar is a special of tying, in which case, b'cheret lashon sudar. The one cheret means in a scarf, like in a scarf. Kamo ha'mitzbachot v'acharitim. Like the word and the kerchiefs and the scarves. So it's claiming that he just took it and put it in like in a bundle, like you would put on your back. He put the whole thing in a scarf. The second interpretation would be a little bit more damning. The second one is v'hasheni v'yatzar lashon tsura b'cheret kli umnot hatzorfin. B'cheret is a goldsmith too. V'shachotzim b'chotim bo tsurot b'zahav, meaning that he actually formed it. Meaning, if I just say that he took it and he held it in his tied it up in a bag, you know, like in a kerchief, and puts it on his back. So that's one thing. But it says v'yatzar ato b'cheret v'yaseu egel masecha. If you take the approach to just tied it up and you get and. If you say that he just tied it up, then vayaseu ego masecha becomes strange. Also, vayaseu is a very difficult word. How would you translate vayasehu? What? Vayaseu ego masecha, vayomru, and this is now the masses, elu elohechi Yisrael asher lucham eretz Mitzrayim. Vayar Aaron, what does he see? So is it that he sees the egel, or is it that he sees how they respond to it? Vayiven mizbeach lefanav, vayikra Aaron, vayomar, chag l'shem achar, which again, if you want to defend Aaron, sounds like a stalling tactic. But by the way, so far in his stalling tactic, he has collected their gold, done something with their gold, built a mizbeach for it. But again, you could say, if you want to defend him, you can say that each step over here is really in order to delay. Yes, yes. Vayeshkimu b'macharat, and you have to love their what would the word be here? Early to bed, early to rise. No, we learned Benjamin for his rizut. There, how do you say his rizut in English? Diligence. It's good to see no one speaks English here. Be a better word. Vayeshkimu b'macharat, vayaleu olot. They offered offerings. Vayagishu shlamim, vayeshev ha'am leechol v'shatu v'yakumu letzachek. Okay, none of that sounds all that good. Letzachek has the connotation Rashi tells us of sexual sins breaking out, so it sounds like a great party. I've always wondered why no one's ever opened up a club called the Golden Calf. Anyone want to invest, we could... There is a place in Vegas called the Golden Steer. I think it's close enough, but... In Las Vegas. Not that I would know. I drove by it around 10 times. At that point, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe, Lech Red Ki Shichet Amcha Asher Lit Meiret Yisrael, which is great, because God says, your people have sinned. Right, it's like two parents, right? Corrupted, right? Your people have sinned. This isn't my people. See, who took them out of Egypt? Moshe took them out of Egypt. You see, God says, "Look what your people have done." Saru maher min aderech asher tzivitim. They've quickly deviated from the path which I've set for them, commanded them. Asu lahem egel masecha. Now, over here, the asu is in the plural, but it's not a convincing plural. Because it's saying the people have made a golden calf. Again, you could have said Aaron made a golden calf, which is part of the question that I want to contemplate. Is it that Aaron made the golden calf, or is it the people made the golden calf? What exactly did each do? And you already saw in the Rashi that Rashi was willing to go in two different ways as far as where the calf came from. The second approach was certainly more damning, because it says that he actually takes out the materials that you make golden things with, and he formed a calf. If Aaron actually formed a calf, then you have to go back and say to yourself, what in the world is he thinking? Why is Aaron doing this? If, on the other hand, he puts it in his thing, and the calf appears, which we'll see as we continue on.
It's still something kind of magical, because how could a human being make something from gold in one day, in less than one day?
Very easily. You just melt it, and then it
doesn't. But that, it's not formed into any kind of form. It's melted gold.
But what if you took it out?
So if you had a mold, it's good. A masicha could mean a mask, yeah. It could, but the word the ego masicha could be a mask. It could be a form, yeah. By the way, it's very interesting. What happens by the end of the parsha? Moshe has a mask on his head by the end, because I keep telling you, because Moshe is really supposed to be the ego. But fine, we'll leave that. Okay. God is not happy, and he says they made for themselves an egel, they've bowed down to it, they've made offerings to it, and they said, this is your God. The truth is, the rest of the stuff is in the plural. Vayishtachavu, vizbechu, vayomru is in the plural. The question over here is asu. And again, I can defend the language by saying, Am Yisrael did it. Do I care which one person did it? Am Yisrael did it. Am Yisrael as a whole is responsible. This is what the people did. Afterwards, when Moshe comes down, this is in source 2, and we already start to clean up. Vayikachata egel asher asu. So it's also interesting because it's again in the plural. Vayisrof be'esh, and it's going to get burnt down. Pasakaf bet. Vayomer Aharon. Now here's Aaron's defense. Al yichar af adoni atoyadata et am kibarahu. Don't be mad at me. You know that these people are in a bad state. Vayomer liaseh lanu Elohim. They said to me, make for us a god. Which is pretty, right, accurate. Va'omar lahem l'mizahav, and he said, whoever has gold, tibarku, which is not an exact statement, but it's close enough. V'yitnuli v'ashlichehu ba'esh, I threw it into the fire. V'yetze ha'egel hazeh. So now, the way that Aaron is saying it, it's like, whoa, look what happened. You know, It's he's not taking responsibility. He's not saying that I took it and I formed it and I made it and I smelt it and all. He doesn't say that. What does he say? He makes it sound like, lo and behold, I threw it in and look what came out. But you'd say ha'egel hazeh. The word paruah here, Rashi translates as uncovered. That he sees their uncoveredness. He sees their sin is clear to all. That's what Rashi says. Same word as sota. Let's just look at source 3 for a moment, which is a little further on in the chapter. Vayomashem Moshe mi asher chatali imcheni mi sifri. Because Moshe said, wipe me out of the book. And God says, no, he who sinned, I'll wipe out of the book. V'atalech nechei et ha'am el asher dibarati lach. Hinei malachi alech lefanechu uviyom pakdi pakadati aleim chatatam. V'yigof Hashem, v'yigof is the word magifa, to strike. V'yigof Hashem et ha'am al asher asu et ha'egel asher asa Aharon. Is that sufficiently unclear? And God struck the people who made the egel, which Aaron made. Now that you have to recognize, that's a very difficult verse. Because make up your mind. Is it that Aaron made it or is it that Yam made it? So till now, we had the initial story, it sounds like Aaron made it, even though we're not completely clear on this. Afterwards, it's Asher Asu Ha'am, that the people did, which sounds plural, which sounds like the people did it. And over here, we have both together. Like, why decide when you could when you can say both? So when it comes down to it, the verses, which really are quite difficult, starting with, just to make sure that we're focused on it, starting with the word cheret, know what the word cheret really means, going on to Vayetzei ha'egel hazeh, this egel appeared, finally noticing that the verse says, Asher asu et ha'egel asher asa Aaron, that they made the egel that Aaron made, which really does sound completely confusing because we're not clear who exactly is guilty for having made this egel. Yes? It looks like the same word. It causes you to think. You're right. Yeah. It definitely linguistically takes you right back to Egypt, which is saying, is there something Egyptian taking place over here? You can't avoid that. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. Right. Okay. So you can say that Aaron did it because they put a gun to his head. Okay. That is definitely a fair interpretation. Now, between the first way that it's taught and the second way that it's taught, there's actually a wonderful tension that exists between the two. Such a tension that if we were to look for a moment, don't be mad. I couldn't decide which order to put this in. Source 17 on page 4. In the olden days, they used to read the Torah, and then they would have somebody who would be mitargem to Aramit. If you've ever davened in a Yemenite shul, there are still places that do this. Now, we're told in this Mishnah, if any of you are learning Daf Yomi, you probably would have seen it within the last week, that there are certain things that we cover up. Just in case you suspected that there are cover-ups in Judaism, yes, there are cover-ups. There are certain things that we don't like to read, certain things we don't like to explain. So the Mishnah says, Ma'aseh Reuven nikra v'lo mitargem. When it comes to what Reuven did, it says, we read it, we don't explain it. So what did Reuven do? So the Chumash says that he went onto his father's bed. So it says that's something that we just read it, we don't explain it. You don't want the people hearing and actually knowing what went on. Which if you want a source, therefore, like they do in the day schools in America, skip all the interesting parts. So over here, you already see a source for this. It says, no, you don't. Certain things you don't explain. You just read it and go on. I mean, of course, the problem is that you have certain day school graduates who don't believe you that it says certain things in the Chumash afterwards because they never saw it. They said, no, that's not in my Chumash. We learned it. Ma'aseh Tamar, by the way, you notice a theme now. Ma'aseh Tamar, nikra u'mitargem. When it comes to what happened with Tamar, there we read it and we're mitargem it. By the way, part of the consideration of the Gemara is not going to be what you think it is. It's not because we're puritanical. It's not what you think. It has to do with somebody being embarrassed because of it. And I'm saying embarrassed in terms of would Reuven be embarrassed? Would Yehuda be embarrassed? If Yehuda did tshuva, or did Reuven did tshuva? If they did tshuva, then it's not a problem to read it because then they get kapara. So it's not simply because we come from puritanical society. But then all that is interesting, but not for today. Then it says, Ma'aseh Egel Harishon Nikra U'mitargem. The first Egel... Slow down. The first Egel, we read and we explain. Right? Nikra mitar. Vahashini, but the second one, nikra v'lo mitargem. The second one we read, but we don't explain. So, of course, what you would like to know is, what is the Egel Rishon and what is the Egel Sheni? Okay? The Egel Rishon and Sheni are the times that the story is repeated. The first time when it happens... we read and explain. The second time, when Aaron comes and says, this is Vayetzei Egel Hazeh, that we read, but we're not mitargem. which of course then you'd have to wonder, so hold it a second, what's the difference between the two? It's the same story, and if it is the same story, then what's the problem with explaining it both times? But over here, again, this is a pretty good rabbinic source, right? This is a Mishnah. And the Mishnah says that when it comes to the Egel story, there are two different stories over here, so different that one can be explained and one can't be explained, because if the second one's explained, there will be problems. What that problem is, should we look, see what the problem is? Let's start with 18, which is the Ra'av. That's Rav Avadya Mibartanura, who has a commentary on Mishnah. Masa Egel Harisha Nikral Mitargeim V'loch. What?
Just on that street.
I thought you just drank that wine. No? V'loch Haishinan Liyikra D'Yisrael. And you don't worry about the status of the Jews. Yikra, how do you say Yakar? The reputation that they'll be, would be devalued. You don't worry that the Jews will take a hit on this. V'lochashin liyikra d'Yisrael. Masa egel asheni min v'yomer Moshe el Aaron ad v'yar Moshe ta'am u'pasuk v'yigof Hashem ta'am kol elu nikraim v'lomet mishum yikra d'Aharon, because of Aharon's reputation. Which means it's saying that the Chet Egel initially is something which the people do, and therefore you read it, you explain it, it's fine. When you get to the second part, where Aaron starts explaining, it says that you don't read because of Aaron's reputation. Now, what's going on over here? Now, that, by the way, that's Rashi's interpretation. Rashi, sorry. That was not Rashi, correct? That was the Rav, the Rav Vadmi Bar Tanura. Let's look at Rashi's interpretation, which is in source 21. Just in source 20, the Gemara there does talk about Kvodon Shi Yisrael, because of the Kavod. And that was the theme having to do with Reuven and Yehuda and so on, having to do with Kavod, not so much with, as I said, with being puritanical, but having to do with Kavod. Rashi, though, in 21, tells us something which you may or may not find interesting. Masa Egel Rishon, Kol Parsha Te Egel, Ad V'Ashlichu Be'esh. Okay, so that now we're clear on the distinction. The initial time of that the narrative tells us what happened with Egel is the first story. Aaron's repetition of the story is Egel Hasheni. Hu shekatuv bo, and what is the main thing that Rashi is concerned about in Egel Hasheni? V'yatsa Egel Hazeh. That's what bothers him. Okay, that's what Rashi says. Hu shekatuv bo v'yatsa ha'egel hazeh. V'lo yiter goman. That you can't explain. Pen yitu am ha'aretz. What's the fear? That the average listener, not the scholar, the average listener will hear this. V'yomru mamash ayabo shiatsa me'ilav. That there was something real that came out, and it came out by itself. By the way, any of you understand this, Rashi?
Yes. No.
What?
Not yet.
Should we read it again? Right. He didn't say that. Pen yitu ami aretz v'yomru mamash hayabo sheyatsa me'elav. That it happened by itself, and there was something real there that came out. Which, of course, what's the problem with that? Go one more step. The problem with that is then thinking that there is something to avodah zarah. So over here, the Mishnah, you know, as explained by the Gemara and as explained by Rashi and others, although Rashi. Not everybody agrees with Rashi on this, that the problem is one of that you would think that the Egel just sort of spontaneously, what's the word? Spontaneous generation? That it just sort of came out. It happened, yeah. Where's Aaron exonerated?
He becomes Kohen Gadol.
That doesn't mean he's exonerated. If you look in Dvarim, if you look in Dvarim, there it says Moshe says that God wanted to kill Aaron because of the Chet Egel.
Okay, but he doesn't get Kohen Gadol. Clearly, the first one. Okay. Clearly, Am Yisrael is outlier, whereas Aaron is a necessary.
Okay, so now, then why not say that, that the Egel just came out? Okay, Rashi is telling you that you can't be metergame this because somebody's going to make a mistake and think that the Egel just spontaneously arrived. But by the way, the problem with this, and again, it could be a misunderstanding. That's why I asked you if you understand Rashi, because I don't. If you understand Rashi, I'd love to understand it. Again, let's go back a step. Aside from the Rashi over here, we have a problem which is delineated in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, this part is read and explained, this part is read and not explained. Right? There's two different parts. Egel Rishon or Egel Sheni is very clearly, I don't know if anybody debates this, is the first narrative and the second narrative. The second narrative is Aaron saying it. What particularly within what Aaron's saying it, that part you can debate. Because that the Mishnah isn't going to. Rashi there says, what is the problematic aspect of Egel Sheni? It's Vayetzeh Egel Hazeh. What's problematic about it? You can think that an Egel just showed up. Yeah.
Yeah. Started to say, is it like Yehuda took responsibility for what he did?
Right.
You know, except Kavi mentioned. Aaron does not take responsibility by saying, oh, poof, it just appeared. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you want to compare the first Egel and the second Egel, you get a hold of the first Egel sounds like Aaron Vayase. In other words, he did it. Okay, I should take responsibility. I'm sorry, I messed up.
Good.
By just saying, poof, it just appeared, it's like, well, you know.
So from
any 4-year-old would say, I don't know. Girl,
many teenagers.
Whatever.
Many adults. Good. You're not explaining Rashi. You're explaining the Mishnah. You're explaining the Mishnah. Okay, that's very good, by the way. This is most of the material that I have in between goes on that point, and it actually centers around a comment that the Re'im made, which drove other people completely crazy. And that is, let's take a look at the Re'im. The Re'im is known as the Mizrahi, and he's a commentary on Rashi. Look at source 13. Okay, so Omar lehem devar acher lemi zahav levad v'heim arut rekuvin nuli de'im lo kein matshuvaya bezeh. Maybe we'll just skip where to underline. Im kein kol hachet haya shelo. Rami is saying, the whole sin is Aaron's sin. Let's not have any cover-up over here. Aaron is responsible. Forget about the whole strategy of saying, no, he was pushing them. He said, bring me the gold. He made it into an egel. He built him his mizbeach. Right? V'ashlecheu ba'esh, v'lo yodati shetha egel hazeh, v'yatza pirish, me'atzmo mi'bultish yotzor to becheret, de'im lo kein ma'i v'yetzeh egel hazeh. He goes, excuse me, if you go back to the first part, and it says he takes a cheret, which he understands as a utensil that you mold gold with. He took the utensil, he molded it, he put it in the fire. Well, guess what? Why vayetze egel hazeh? Because that's what he put into the fire. So, of course, vayetze egel hazeh. So therefore, he's claiming over here that if you compare the two, when Aaron says, and I'm glad I didn't say this, that Elaine said it, where he speaks like a 4-year-old and says, excuse me, this wasn't me, it just happened, he's attacking him for this and saying, no, what do you mean it just happened? You made the Egel, it didn't just happen. And then he continues and he says, separate sort of egel, but hechrech shetsa egel hazeh. Aval b'mashe ida lavakatuv shebemkom she'amar lemoshe va'omer lahem lemizahav levadu amar perkunis meizahav asher ba'oznei neshechem b'nechem v'notechem v'viyoy lai uvemalkom she'amar lemoshe v'ashlichu be'esh v'yatsa egel hazeh me'atzmo hu lakachet etzav v'yitzar oto b'cheret v'yaseo egel masecha nira shebepnei yirato mimoshe hotzi sheker mipiv. Should I translate? Says that Aaron lied to Moshe about the egel. Cover-up. Right? That the cover-up begins with Aaron. Aaron lies to Moshe, doesn't take responsibility, says the people did it. Like, what did I do? The people did it. I didn't do anything over here. And because he lied, that's the reason. Again, it's interesting. He says, what do we explain when we do the Targum? What do you explain? This is your approach. What do you explain? You explain what really happened. What don't you explain? You don't explain the part where Aaron covers up, because Aaron covering up is really an embarrassment to Aaron, and therefore it falls more in line with that you don't explain things that can cause embarrassment to people. Right? This is what you were thinking? Yes.
But yet, if you go back to the original, God's original saying to Moshe about what just happened,
yeah.
He did not even mention
it. Right, right. And you still, and you have your point still. And you have your point still, then Aaron still becomes Kohen Gadol, which, you know, how do these things go together? By the way, needless to say, many commentators are not happy at all with this. They don't like the idea. If you look at the Kli Yakar, for example, in source 14, V'yishlichu la'esh la'haticho, sharei kach amar Aaron l'moshe, v'yishlichu ba'esh v'tza'egel hazeh, u'b'lis safek shehigid lo emet. Right, there's no question that he must be speaking the truth, because how can you say any different?
Yeah. If God didn't say anything about Aaron, but then why did Moshe go to Aaron and say, "What did you do?"
Mm-hmm.
Where did Moshe get that?
Well, you were in charge. He was in charge.
Yes.
The Maharal in source 16, the Gur Aryeh, is also a commentary on Rashi. Lo yadati shetza egel hazeh, ein pirusho shayotze ha'egel me'atzmo, dehachti v'yitzer oto b'cher v'yitzer egel masecha. Don't say it came out by itself. V'ahra ein piresh ki mebnei ha'yira hotzi sheker mipiv, v'dover ze'eino. V'shnei ha'yira motzi adam sheker ma'she'ein yodei abo adam. When you're scared, you lie, something that no one else is going to know. Abal adov shekol Yisrael yadush aron asalto, eich shekem zeh shetzi sheker mipiv. How can you claim that he lies about? You can't lie about something which everybody knows. It's not going to work that well. Bemilta de avidid lagului, anything which is going to become public. Avokach perusho vayitzei egel hazeh shahaya bochayim. This is fascinating, because what does the Maharal claim? That the eagle was animated. It was not an inanimate. That's the Maharal. Because the golem. No place in any of the Maharal's writings does he speak about a golem. It's in none of his writings. It means that if you want me to talk about it, I'll talk about it sometime, but not now. In no place in the Maharal's writings does it talk about the Maharal making a golem. And the first person to write it in Hebrew was in 1909, which is 300 years, the 300th anniversary of the Maharal's death. So that's a long time. Anyway, but he does say that this eagle that comes out animated. Ki Aaron afagav shasa eagle savor shaloya davarbo, v'lo yishtachav ulamet. Aaron made an eagle, but didn't think it would be animated, didn't think that the thing's going to come to life. V'yetzei ha'eagle hazeh, comes again, that's what he said. Aaron didn't lie. Yes, I made it, I formed it, whatever, but look, this thing came to life. Umach shafei erev rav asu bikshafim bishashi shlichat azahav lakur shiye bochayim. Ach shiye nase tzurato. But no, it was some kind of Egyptian magic from the erev rav that caused this thing to come to life. Ulefichem av hashlevi yatzei egel hazeh sheyesh bo chayim. V'lo hayebo mitchilat chayim rakach she'asa et tzurato. That Aaron made the form, but Aaron did not bring the thing to life, and the Maharal would prefer to defend Aaron and say, Chas v'shalom, that Aaron lied, and how can you claim it's a lie, and how can you claim that he would have said such a thing, but rather what must be going on over here is that this thing was animated. Now, I want to go back to Rashi and to see the way that Rashi himself explains how the eagle came out. Which means Rashi doesn't explain it on the words Vayetze Egel Hazeh. Rashi explains it in source number 6 on the words Egel Masecha. They made an Egel Masecha. Rashi says as follows, source 6. Kevin shehishlichu la'ur, when they threw it into the fire, bikur, in the oven, furnace, thank you. Bo machshafei erev rav shalu imahem mimitzrayim. So now you see the Maharal, where he's getting it from. Again, he is a commentary in Rashi. The erev rav came, but not just the erev rav, it wasn't just the hangers-on, it was the hanger, they had some people that knew wizardry. V'yasu bikshafim, and they did it with kishuf, they did it with magic. So that's the first opinion about what happened, is that the whole Egel, forget it, he doesn't say anything about animation. The whole Egel comes because Aaron, again, go back to Rashi. What was Rashi's first comment as far as what he did with the gold, the cheret? Rashi didn't say that it means that he actually formed it. He puts it in, on his back, he puts it in a handkerchief, in a kerchief, and the gold is there, but Vayetziah Egel is a, he said the first commentary, it must have been because of magic. V'yesh Omer, and Rashi says, no, it wasn't from the Egyptians. Micha ha-yasham, Shiyotza mitoch demuse binyan shenit ma'echbo b'mitzrayim v'hoyi biyado shem v'tas shekatuvbo Moshe alei shur lalot arano shel Yosef mitoch nilus v'shlich lotoch ha-ki'ur v'yatzah ha-egel. No, it was Micha that was there who was taken out from among the bricks in Egypt, and he had in his hand something that said God's name, Hashem, it had God's name, and that's what Moshe used to get Yosef out when he was looking for Yosef's remains, and it said on Alei Shur, and the Alei Shur, meaning that a bull should come up, and he threw it in, and that's the Vayetzeh HaEgel. Now this is incredible. First of all, it's fascinating, and I don't know if we'll have time to get to this, is what did poor Yosef do to get dragged into this story? You know? Okay, so he spoke about his brothers, you know, a good couple hundred years before this, and we're still dragging Yosef in, that somehow Yosef's now responsible for, he's responsible also for everything else, but he's also responsible now for the Egel HaZahav. Right? So why drag Yosef into this? That definitely needs to be explained. No, I don't know if we'll get there. But who is this Micha that he's talking? Oh, Micha was there. Ah, so if you want to know who Micha was, look at source number 7. Micha is actually quite famous. V'yehish mehar Ephraim u'shemo Michayahu. So who is this Michayahu? V'yomel imo elu v'meya kesef hashel u'kachlach. He says all this money that was taken from you. So the first thing over here is the theme of money and having maybe an excess of money. V'at alit v'gam amart ba'az nai hinei kesef iti ani lakachti v'tomer imi baruch b'ni la'ashem. The money was taken from you for which you cursed, and you spoke about it, saying, the money is with me, I took it. And his mother said, blessed be you of the Lord my God. Now, you're not getting anything yet. He gets the money back. And he said that he consecrates the money to make an engraved image, a molten image. So over here you have him using this to make a pesel and to make a masecha. Correct. V'yashev et ha-kesef limo v'tikach imo matayim kesef v'tenei l'tzoref v'yaseu pesel u'masecha v'yihi b'veit Michayahu v'ish Micha, so now you see he's also called Micha, lo beit Elohim, or beit Elohim it would be, he builds himself a house of God, v'yas ephod u'trafim, we were missing the trafim, now we have trafim as well, v'yamalei et yad acher mi'banav v'yihi lo l'kohen, and he appoints one of his sons Kohen, v'yamim ahim in melech b'Yisrael ish ha'yashar b'nav v'yaseh, which is it what? Well, it doesn't say it makes an egel, but what you do see is in making a pesel, making masecha, and making trafim, and he points his son Kohen, the chapter, you can go back and look it up yourself. He then finds a levi for his Kohen, because he made his son a Kohen, and not a nice story. So who is this Micha? So over here, Rashi said, oh no, this is the same Micha. Now, one second. I know that Chazal work with the theory of conservation of characters, and therefore the same Micha who's going to do Avodah Zarah down the line is the Micha who did the Avodah Zarah here, but there's a little bit more to the story to understand who this Micha was. And Rashi gave us a little bit of insight when he says this Micha was crushed in the bricks. Now, there are various versions of this. Let's take a look at source number 8. Rabbeinu Bachai doesn't add much to us from what we've already seen before. The only thing that he adds is at the very end, as he tells us, he's almost Rashi word for word, but at the end he says, at the end, he's the one who said, Eilel Hecha Yisrael, Al kei nekra micha al shem shenitma ach bebinyan. That lemoch means to crush, and therefore he was called Micha because he was this baby that was crushed in the building of you want to say the pyramids or whatever it is that they built when the Jews were there. But he doesn't tell us the entire story about what happened. Source number 9, the Balei Tosfot tells us the same thing. He says, "V'yesh mefarshim micha ha'yesham shiotz mitocha binyan shenit ma'ech ba'mitzrayim v'tzarech pirish lepirish zeh." He goes, "This explanation needs an explanation because there's something not working here." Shahayu mishka'im tinakot yisraelim b'binyan v'hayam Moshe mitzta'er, that they would use Jewish babies in the building of the pyramids, which means the same way that Nazis would use Jewish bodies to make soap. They use Jews in order to make their buildings. They use them as bricks. They use them as mixed up within the building. And Moshe was very upset with this. Omalei Kadosh Baruch Hu al titzta'er. And God says, don't be upset. But by the way, who are you siding with right now? With God or with Moshe? To be upset or not to be upset? Al titzta'er ki kol hamushka'im, all of the children that or the babies that are being used, sofam ha'yila kalkel ma'aseyim. I chose all the ones that were going to sin, and those are the ones that were being used. God said, I already decided that the ones that were being used are the bad ones, the good ones are saved, and don't worry about that. I'm God. I know what's going on. Right? So from here, the cookie I say, Vizaruk shmi hamifurash alot echad mehem. God says to Moshe, you want to test this out? Take the shem hamifurash, take God's holy name, throw it in, and get one of them out. Save one of them. V'tir'eh ma'achriyoto. And let's see how it works out. L'kach misham v'hishlichu v'hele micha. He wrote God's name, threw it in, and this micha came out. And again, why the name micha? That you already learned, because he's the one who was crushed. This is Tosfot's commentary on the Chumash. I want to know if I'm allowed to teach it in this class?
No, I'm just wondering how
things. Is it interesting? Good. That's my job. Are you upset?
No, but when I say at the table, everyone goes, oh, that's just midrash.
So smack them. Pour the soup on them by accident. What's that? Right. And Micha pops up, but he's still holding on to God's name because that's what took him out of there. And he's the one who threw this into the furnace. And then the eagle came out. And that's why it's called Micha, because he's the one who was crushed in the building. This is very interesting. I don't know where to begin. First of all, what you have over here is what we would have considered before we knew otherwise. We would have considered a tragic death of an innocent baby. And I don't think we would have gotten any, I don't think we should have or would have gotten past that. And, you know, that's enough. Moshe seems to question God. And by the way, it's not the only time that Moshe questions God as far as this kind of topic goes. If I can very quickly remind you, and there is this famous Gemara where Moshe wanders in with God's instruction into Rabbi Akiva's classroom, and he sees Rabbi Akiva, and then he asks afterwards, he says, you showed me his wisdom, you showed me his Torah, can you show me the reward that he gets? And then it says that, he says, go back, and he takes a look, and he sees Rabbi Akiva's lifeless body hanging on a meat hook, right? It's very hard to imagine how God could have produced a more horrific image for Moshe to see. So now, what's fascinating about that is, obviously, Moshe is going to ask the question that all of us would ask. He said, let me see his schar. He showed me his Torah. Let me see his schar, his reward. Let me see his reward. And he shows him Rabbi Kiva's, again, lifeless body that was tortured, hanging on a meat hook. And Moshe then says the obvious question that all of us would ask. Zu Torah v'zu schorah? This is Torah and this is its reward? And God does not provide him with an answer. Right? Now, what's interesting about this is that if we compare Rabbi Akiva's death as described in the Gemara in Menachot that I just now read, with the Gemara in Brachot that talks about when it came time for Moshe, when it came time for Rabbi Akiva to be executed, it was time to say Shema, and he starts to say the Shema, and all the people, all the students are listening. Rabbi, even now, he says, my whole life I've waited for this, and you know the whole scene. So, first of all, it's fascinating, none of that's there. Had Moshe seen this previous, you know, image, the previous scene, go back one, you know, one frame, and see all, you know, of the students of Rabbi Akiva listen to Rabbi Akiva say Shema and see, you know, the spiritual, you know, experience that was going on, even though it's tragic, I think it would have looked very different. One second. Go to the next scene as told in the Gemara Brachot. When Rabbi Akiva dies, what does it say happens? It says his neshama goes up into heaven and a voice comes out of heaven saying that Rabbi Akiva is like, welcome to the world to come, and so on and so forth. Which means you have the previous scene down below, Rabbi Akiva b'makadei shem shemayim. You have the next scene, which takes place in heaven. But what does he show? What does he show Moshe? He shows the other scene. He shows Rabbi Akiva's lifeless body. He doesn't show the neshama in heaven, and he doesn't show the scene beforehand. Which means those of us who have seen the whole movie will not question the same way that Moshe questions. Which means God puts him in a situation by saying, "How can he not question this?" But by the way, this Gemara, I don't believe, is part of the problem of what we would call theodicy, of why bad things happen to good people. This Gemara provides an explanation for it. This Gemara is saying is that even Moshe, the most, you know, most learned of men, has limited perspective. And having limited perspective, he doesn't see the previous scene, doesn't see the next scene, he's focused on this scene, and presumably, if you saw the scene before and saw the scene after, and you know exactly how things are going to play out, then, meaning if you have God's knowledge, then you don't question what God does. Again, the questioning of God's fairness emerges out of not having God's knowledge. That's the response which is being given over here. And therefore, Moshe is looking, going back to the Midrash that we just now saw. Moshe is looking at a horrific scene, and his response to God is obvious. How can you know this be? And God says, no, only the ones that are there, nothing good was going to come of them. Now, you hear this, and you say, well, that's God's perspective. God can say, you want to try? You want to try me? See, this is unbelievably disturbing, because if this is the case, then this is telling you that ultimately, who's responsible for the Chetah Egel? Is it the people or Aaron, or is it Moshe, or is it God? You want to share responsibility? Which means, if God gives Moshe the idea of using the Shema Farash to take out Micha, to help Micha be saved, and Micha uses it, so now Moshe has the same responsibility that Aaron does. We can debate this, but ultimately we can say it's God's fault. God wanted this to happen, else he never would have done all of this. And as I said, you now go back and say, who's responsible for the Chet Egel? And now you can be completely confused. So of course it's God's fault. Everything comes down to be God's fault. Or your mother. What? See, the other thing about Micha, which intrigues me, is that it's the innocent face of a child, right? The innocent face of a child is a very difficult thing for us to even begin to process how the innocent child can suffer, and the explanation, because all the child will do terrible things, is not really satisfying. But the image of the face of the child does something else for me within the context of the ego. And what's that? That takes us back to the Kruvim. Which means that the cherubs, the Kruvim, which means ultimately, what's the difference between the Kruvim, which are standing inside the Beit HaMikdash, and by the way, the Kruvim, let's all appreciate this. If God never would have said to make an Egel, if God never would have said to make Kruvim, God would have said to make an Egel and put it inside the Beit HaMikdash, you would be fine with it. If God would have said for them to make an Egel and they made Kruvim, and it was the sin of the Karuv, it wouldn't have been the same, which means the sin of the Egel is not that they made an Egel, it's that God didn't tell them to make an Egel. That's the sin of the Egel, which therefore shows us what? That sometimes symbolism is okay in Judaism, and sometimes you're allowed to make things. And when you're allowed to make things? When God tells you to make things. What if God doesn't tell you to make it? Then what is it called? Avodah Zarah. Strange service. Different service. But if God tells you to do it, it's not Avodah Zarah. Right. It's Avodah Hashem.
It's called Avodah too.
Correct. Interesting, but if you go back now and you realize the similarity between the Karuv and between Micha, and saying that ultimately this is coming, you know, from one step further back, So then he has to start thinking about, you know, what is this concept of the Kruv? Which, as I said, takes us back to the Merkava, takes us back to Yechezkel, and takes us back to this idea of certain symbols become acceptable. But at the core of the problem, I want to just touch one more thing, and that's the second thing that Rashi tells us about, is that maybe, because maybe it's Micha, or maybe it's the name Rashi combines it together, other commentaries separate them, is it come from that Micha had the name of God, or it was from Vayalehu Yosef, when they really dragged Yosef into all of this. So why should Yosef be dragged into it? I mean, again, what did Yosef ever do wrong? The one thing about Yosef which stands out, and you can argue with me, say, oh, other things stand out. One thing about Yosef which stands out is the beauty of Yosef, is that Yosef is the only male that I know of in the Torah who's described as being beautiful. Right? May have been other good-looking men, but Yosef is the only one that the Torah tells us. According to Midrashim, Yaakov was beautiful. According to Midrashim, Yaakov has the beauty of Adam and Chumash. Correct. It's important to the narrative. And that's where it's introduced, in the middle of the story. I don't want to go too late, but the idea of Yosef somehow being connected with Avodah Zarah is something which we need to understand a little bit, and as I said, we're not going to go as far as we could. All of the Avot had spiritual greatness. The Maharal explains this, Rav Dessler explains this, not always the same. But you have the spiritual greatness of Avraham and the counterfeit of that. Avraham's chesed, the counterfeit of that, is Yishmael's Gili Arayot. I mean, there's Midrashim that explain this. The greatness of Yitzchak is Gvura, and the counterfeit of that is strength, and the counterfeit of that is Esav's murderous ways. Which means the counterfeit of chesed, counterfeit chesed, is gilui arayot. Real chesed is loving. Counterfeit chesed is gilui arayot. It's very, very close, and it can be a very, very thin line. Gilui arayot is sexual sins. So therefore, sexuality could be expression of love, it could be expression of compassion. There's all kinds of ways that people should share, and that people should give, and that people have to extend themselves. But when it comes to sexuality, there needs to be boundaries, but a generation, let's say, for example, that has absolutely free love, does it mean free love? Does it mean free sex? Free love is wonderful. Ahavat chinam is wonderful. But the problem is, in the 60s, they didn't talk about ahavat chinam, meaning that we should love one another, they mean they should have sex with everyone. That again, you can say there's a very thin line between the two, but Avraham is somebody who talks about loving one's neighbor as yourself, but the counterfeit of that seems to be Yishmael, and again, there are Midrashim that identify this. With Yitzchak, the main spiritual component is one of Gvura, one of strength. In Judaism, Ezu Gibor HaKoveshet Yitzro, practicing self-control, and the counterfeit of that is using strength on other people, and that's the strength that Esav uses. Yaakov then becomes the combination between. Yaakov is Tiferet. Tiferet means, how do you translate Tiferet? It could be glory, and it also can have a connotation of beauty, which means the beauty of Yaakov is the ability of combining everything together. Now, there's also a problem with that. There's a klipa in Kabbalistic terminology. There's a klipa, or there's a counterfeit. There's a problem when you become all-inclusive, because when you become all-inclusive, what do you do with things that shouldn't be included? Which means if Yaakov includes the chesed of Avraham includes the strength of Yitzchak, and it comes together, and now you have beauty because everything's combined. When everything is combined, what do you do with that egel, and what do you do with that rock, and what do you do with that form, and what do you do with that symbol? Because that could lead to Avodah Zarah as well, once everything has beauty to it. Which leads us to a point, ultimately, what do you do with Avodah Zarah? Now again, on a technical level, Avodah Zarah is wrong. I'm going to explain again. I'm doing this far too briefly, but I just wanted to show you two approaches to a different parsha, to the Akedah. Approach of Rav Soloveitchik, as he told over from his grandfather, and an approach of Rav Kook. Now, before I go any further, Rav Soloveitchik's spiritual world was filled with tension. There's tension in everything. Everything becomes a dialectic. Everything becomes, there's two sides to it. Everything is a world of spiritual tension. Out of spiritual tension comes creativity and comes at some point a resolution. Although he'll stress that very often the resolution exists with both the thesis and the antithesis existing with one another, and now there's something which is this new point which is created, but both of them are there. It's not the type of a dialectic where the thesis and antithesis disappear, and now you have a synthesis which take their place. For Rav Soloveitchik, tensions always exist. So when Rav Soloveitchik spoke about the Akedah, it became a very simple thing. Again, pure, brisk intellectuality or intellectualism. Reb Chaim said, what's the problem of the Akedah? What's the problem of God saying to Avraham to offer your son? He says, on the one hand, God says, take your son and offer him. Okay, so that's the word of God, so you should go do it. On the other hand, God said, but through Yitzchak, you will have progeny. So now I have a contradiction. So he says, what do you do when you have two verses that contradict one another? So you wait till you find the third verse, which creates the explanation, which means you have thesis, you have antithesis, and for him it's no problem living in a thesis-antithesis existence until you find your resolution to it. And fine, by the way, there's a very simple resolution. Very simple resolution of the Akedah is you kill him and he comes back to life, and then and everything works. But as I said, for Rav Soloveitchik, it becomes this intellectual process, tension, but you go further until something presents itself. Rav Kook, when it came to the Akedah, said the opposite of what you would think. For us, the whole test of the Akedah is he loves his son, and how can he want to kill his son, and how can a person possibly do this? So Rav Kook says you need to understand the world of Avodah Zarah, because that was the world that Avraham lived in. Sometimes when I want to bother my students, I ask them if they think that if he was raised as an idolater, do you think he ever had any other kids that he killed beforehand? That was the done thing. That's how he grew up. He said, did he worship idolatry when he was young? So they get very, very bothered by this. But it's good. As I said, see, that's my job, is to say things to bother people. But, what?
I'll never invite you.
If the food is good, I won't talk. So Rav Kook said that that Avram comes out of a world of Avodah Zarah, and Avodah Zarah has holiness as well. So hold it. For Rav Kook, where Soloveitchik has attention to everything, Rav Kook, everything is included within this glorious creation of God. And for Rav Kook, everything is a part of spirituality, and there's no tension in Rav Kook's writings. Rav Kook is just this all-inclusive that there's love, godliness, divinity in everything. And it just becomes this idea of uncovering the divine within. So for Rav Kook, even within idolatry, there are divine sparks. And therefore, he says, no, Avraham's going to go to the Akedah, and he wants to do it because there is something holy within idolatry. What's holy about idolatry? This ability or desire to give up everything for this deity. The deity is telling you want your most precious thing. You give the most precious thing that there is, which means when it comes down to it, again, if you take the approach of Rav Kook, which as it could be incredibly disturbing, but if and how you work this out in practical terms could also be very dangerous, because you can very easily walk cross the border into pantheism. You can very easily cross the border into idolatry itself. But what he's saying, no, is that there are divine sparks in everything. And if there's divine sparks in everything, there are even going to be divine sparks in Avodah Zarah. And the challenge over here is to take that divine and bring it into the Beit HaMikdash, and to bring it into the Holy of Holies, and to bring it into where the Kruvim are. Which means, ultimately, this question is like, what exactly is the sin, and how bad is it to use symbols? He would go back, and now I'm putting words in his mouth, he would go back and play, that's not that bad at all, which means the passion of wanting to serve God with all of your heart and all your soul is not a bad thing. The passion of wanting to serve God with that which is most valuable is not a bad thing. Acting out on it and hurting other people in the process, that's definitely bad about it. But there's something which is pure within it. So I'm saying, I find it fascinating now, realizing that we have a midrash which is identifying this with Micha, who is this baby that you can look at as being pure, which looks like the Kruv, but now there's going to be a difference between the two. Over here, God is saying, no, this is not acceptable, and it's not necessary, and it's not needed, and bad things will come of it, and idolatry will come of it. One which will be outside, and kol ashar, and kol achad yashar be'inav ya'aseh, each person doing whatever they want to do, versus the type of avodat Hashem, which comes from the same pure, childlike place, which is represented by the Kruvim, which will be inside the Mishkan and inside the Beit HaMikdash. When you take the beauty of Yosef, you can focus just on beauty, which is the beauty of Yaakov, which is the idea of Tiferet. You can focus it on the outside and see it as being something which is external to Avodat Hashem and something which is fundamentally dangerous. And that's where the danger lies. The danger lies by taking the beauty of Yosef, like most likely the Hellenized Jews did, by focusing on something which is outward and using that as a replacement for the Beit HaMikdash. By taking the Beit HaMikdash and turning it into someplace which is Greek worship, which focuses on the outside instead of focusing on the purity of the inside. And that may be, the power of that, may be where Yosef gets dragged into all of this, where it doesn't seem to have any connection with Yosef whatsoever. But as I said from the very beginning, that this sin and who is responsible, we can keep on going back to the sources. There are many more commentaries. The verses themselves are quite difficult. Aaron does something. What exactly is it that Aaron does? We can debate this. What I find also interesting is that Rashi's commentary on the Gemara ends up very different than his commentary over here, because over here it sounds like exactly what he's telling you not to suspect is what happened, is that Vayatza ha'egel hazeh, that this eagle emerged. Why the eagle emerged, we saw Rashi give some very, very interesting interpretations, and it sounds as if it's something which almost, I'm saying, that people needed to come out. But over here, if you look at all the other commentaries, where you want to point the finger, you can make your decision. If you want to blame Aaron, you want to blame Am Yisrael, blame the Erev Rav, you want to blame Moshe, you want to blame God himself for it, you have plenty of people to blame. But ultimately, what I think Elaine said is correct, that the problem is that he doesn't take responsibility. And taking responsibility for it, then we could have explained it, and we could have read it, and then everything would have been understandable. Next week, I'm not going to be here. Do you want class? Want someone else? Or are you ready obsessing on Pesach?